someone.
Here, Henry.
Thank you, George.
You're pretty good. You don't get a new body, you could always get a job as a soccer ball.
George!
Well, everybody ought to have a job if they want it, shouldn't
they? He has your deal,
Richard. Does he? Fine. Be a soccer ball if you wish. Thomas, how are you in the Justice Department making up?
So far, pretty good, Count Cheney.
Have we found precedent for suspending the elections?
Well, we haven't actually found any precedent in the U.S., but we found some in history.
Thomas, you aren't thinking about the czars.
Well, they regularly suspended Russian law pretty successfully.
Yes, but it all ended rather badly, didn't it? A little thing called the Russian Revolution?
Well, yeah. On the other hand, Janosz Bunyat of Slavonakia suspended elections and ensured peace by having his parliament killed. And Perkadan the VII of ancient Crapola saved his nation by seizing power as permanent regent. Well, until his son poisoned him a couple of years later. And we all remember Kodos the Executioner.
That's from an old Star Trek episode, Tom.
You know, I told my staff I thought that one was...
So odd. How's this gonna work?
We're arranging with some of our, shall we say, more troublesome allies to pull off an attack that will embarrass our democratic friends and force you to reluctantly suspend the November elections until we can ensure Americans.
We were thinking about crashing an airplane into the Fleet Center in Boston during their convention, but it's too obvious.
Yeah, that ain't gonna work. They're already suspicious of everything we do.
True enough, of course. However, we can also use a few extra tricks.
The Gestapo used to kill one of their own to force people to talk. We thought perhaps we could shoot Secretary Powell and say it was leftists.
Huh, that's pretty good. We don't like Colin anyway. We were hoping you'd see it that way, George. Your father always had those scruples.
Well, I remember when he lost them, right after he left office, wandering around Kenny Bunkport sighing and saying, anybody seen my scruples? Left them here someplace.
Well, he didn't have many to lose. The point being that we have options, since you aren't capable of winning on merit.
Doctor?
Thomas?
We were also looking into rules governing martial law.
Ah! What have you discovered?
Well, if we declare martial law any time we stage an attack, we can repeal it whenever we want to, years later if necessary. And under martial law, we can get six kinds of nasty with national security.
I beg your pardon? Six kinds of nasty?
Merely an expression, Master.
We can strengthen patriot is what I meant, sir.
Ah, I see. Well, Henry, when should we enact our plan?
For something so drastic, it would behoove us to wait as long as possible. The 8th month is out. The Democrats will get another boost from their convention, of course.
Do we need to worry about that?
Certainly not, but if it does not subside after a couple of weeks, then we shall have to rethink. Perhaps initiate our plan in the 9th month.
We had best speak only in code about it. I move that we refer to it as Plan 9.
Okay.
Fine, Richard.
Plan 9? Oh, dear.
Something, Donald?
Plan 9 from Outer Space is generally conceded to be the worst movie ever made. Should we really invite the comparison?
That's pretty funny. Sure better than Bela Lugosi meets a Brooklyn gorilla.
Perhaps not.
I don't know.
It seems rather appropriate somehow. If our plan fails, we can claim we were only making a film.
Starring George? I don't know, sir. Can he act?
Folks think I'm still optimistic about the economy, don't they?
Very good, George. You do really care about the economy, don't
you? Sure.
Oh, Mr. President!
Yeah, sure.
Episode 72 of The Adventures of Huckleberry Bush, President of the Known World, was written and produced by Uncle Bob Young and the Average Network.
The conquistadors came with their sabers and guns, and they raped and they slaughtered until they were done. They hacked and they killed and left no one alive. Then they brought in the slaves they allowed to survive. Welcome to the new world, you could hear the men say, as they sat on the shores of Guantanamo Bay. And after 400 years, independence was short. That's just how it is with the deep water port. The battleships came and they never left shore, tasting the conquest, they just wanted more. the sign that said, "Welcome to the U.S. of A." In the Republic of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. Past the barbed wire and the field of mines, you can see the men who left their families behind to burn 'neath the sun, to be tortured and killed, where their stomachs are empty and their spirits are grilled. If you're looking for freedom, this is the price you must pay. It's written in blood on Guantanamo Bay. Vultures, they circle at ease overhead. The living may live and the dead will be dead. The time it may come in this tropical heat that they'll have to go somewhere else to eat. Maybe a storm will come wash it away. But still the guard towers glitter on Guantanamo Bay.
We go now to a talk that was given in Toronto late last May during Phase 2 of the Citizens' Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11.
Our next guest is a former fighter pilot in the United States Air Force, where he served for 22 years, including 101 combat missions in Vietnam. He is also a presiding archbishop in the United Catholic Church and is a peace activist in his community. And he has constantly spoken out against the war in Iraq. Will you please give a warm welcome from Melbourne, Florida, Dr. Robert Bowman.
We're here to talk about 9/11. But as you've noticed, 9/11 is related to just about everything else, particularly the war against Iraq. These two things have one aspect very much in common. They are both, in my opinion, treason. I'd like to read a paragraph from an article that I published called "Some Dare Call It Treason." The cabal of neoconservatives at PNAC, I think you all know what that is, who planned this war, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Libby, Pearl, Jeb Bush, even before W became president, I don't say elected, I say became president, this cabal knew the American people would not stand for a war against Iraq, unless there was, as they put it in their own document, a new Pearl Harbor. 9/11 supplied that. Our government was warned. They were warned by the Clinton administration about Osama bin Laden. They were warned by the intelligence agencies of 11 other countries about what was planned for September. And they were specifically warned by an FBI agent that Mousawi was planning on flying a hijacked airliner, quote, into the World Trade Center, unquote. Our government not only ignored the warnings, they made sure no fighter jets were scrambled to stop it. If they had just done nothing and allowed normal, everyday procedures to be followed, the Twin Towers would still be standing and thousands of dead Americans would still be alive. This is not stupidity. It is treason. There are a lot of questions about what really happened on 9/11. There are many different conspiracy theories flying around the internet like seagulls around a landfill. Many of these theories seem to contradict one another. Many people are convinced that George W. Bush knew what was going to happen and purposely allowed it to happen. Others go further. They are absolutely sure Cheney and company actually planned and carried out the attack, usually along with the Mossad. These folks don't think there were ever any Arab hijackers at all. What is so disturbing is that their arguments are quite convincing. If an enormous cloud of suspicion is not to be permanently over the head of our government, the Bush administration must come clean, releasing information thus far withheld from the American people. Now, clearing themselves of actively planning and carrying out the 9/11 attacks ought to be fairly easy. All they have to do is to give the American people the answers to a few key questions. One, why were there no Arab names on the passenger lists provided by the airlines? Two, what exactly is the status of the remote control system which conspiracy theorists say was used to hijack the airliners, a system designed to thwart hijackers by moving control from the cockpit to ground controllers? Three, why is there no evidence of Flight 77, which supposedly flew into the Pentagon? Why was there such a small hole in the Pentagon? Why were no wings or engines found? Why are there no eyewitnesses that saw the plane? Give us the evidence that it happened the way you say, and that the Pentagon was not hit by a U.S. missile and Flight 77 shot down over the ocean. Now, there are lots more questions, but you get the idea, and during this week, you've probably heard most of them. If our government answers but a few of these questions, the most virulent of the conspiracy theories goes away. Dealing with the other major theory, however, that Osama bin Laden really did it, but Bush and company let it happen, this will require more answers. Here are just a few. What was in the CIA daily brief presented to the president on August 6, 2001? And why has it been withheld for so long? Why have still, after all this time, only a handful of hand-picked congressmen have seen most of it? Why did John Ashcroft and top Pentagon officials cancel plans to fly commercial airlines the morning of 9/11? If they knew what was about to happen, why wasn't it stopped? Who made all the millions of dollars selling short United and American Airlines just before 9/11? The hijackers obviously had no use for the money. Who besides them knew that these two particular airlines were going to suffer devastating losses on 9/11? Why weren't the hijacked airliners intercepted by jet fighters and shot down before they could fly into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? The transponders on the airliners were turned off. The hijackers were heard on the radio. The four airliners deviated drastically from their assigned courses. Stewardesses on the plane reported the hijacking to their airline headquarters, described the hijackers, said what seats they were in, and told about the killings of the crew members. Why wasn't NORAD told immediately? There's another question that's sort of a sideline. What was the president doing sitting in a classroom for half an hour after he was told that the country was under attack? Why didn't the Secret Service rush him away from where everyone knew he was, unless they knew he wasn't a target? Well, there's lots more. I have been asked specifically as a fighter pilot with 101 combat missions over Vietnam to address the question of why the airliners weren't stopped. There's a lot of stuff on the internet which blames the interceptor pilots. They quote the F-16 having a top speed of 1,500 miles an hour. The F-15 of having a top speed of over 1,800 miles an hour. And they say, look, they were only 135 miles from where they had to go to protect. What took them so long? Why was their average speed only a quarter of their top speed? Well, I think that's one that I can answer. I've done a bit of study into this. I have some personal experience with doing intercepts from being on alert. Those quoted top speeds are only under very particular circumstances. Normally, those speeds can only be attained at very high altitude, where the air is thin and the drag reduced. It takes a long time to accelerate to those speeds. You have to climb up to that high altitude, and when you're climbing, a lot of your energy goes into the climb, not to accelerating and increasing your speed. The flight times we're talking about are fairly short, from 10 to 20 minutes. In that time, you can barely reach your maximum speed. You certainly can't maintain it as an average. After all, you start from zero. Depending on which way the wind's blowing, you may be taking off in a direction opposite to that you want to go. And then you have to turn around, and that takes a couple of minutes. I've done a look at the timelines, and I've reached several conclusions. The first conclusion is that considering takeoff roll, acceleration time, climb time, turn time, the effect of altitude on top speed, wind, there is absolutely no evidence that the interceptor pilots could have gotten to their targets any faster. Second, given the time they got the word to scramble, neither the F-15s or the F-16s could have gotten to the World Trade Center or the Pentagon in time to stop the hijackers, even flying at top speed under even the best of circumstances. In other words, it wasn't the pilots' fault. But there's another conclusion that we reach by going down the timeline. We look at the fact that contact was lost with American Airlines 11 at 8:13:50 a.m., that the transponder stopped at 8:20, that the airliner went off course at 8:20. That at 8:21, a stewardess reported the hijacking. So it's reasonable to me to think that within 5 minutes, somebody should have told NORAD and gotten those planes scrambled. The planes, in short, should have been scrambled at 8:26. They were actually scrambled at 8:46, 20 minutes later. They got airborne in 6 minutes, which is about as good as you can do, having to run out and jump in the plane and start the engines and get out to the runway. So they could have been airborne at 8:32. Based on going full throttle, afterburner, all the way, getting there in the shortest possible time, they could have intercepted American Airlines Flight 11 at 8:42 and been at the World Trade Center at 8:43. The first plane didn't hit World Trade Center until 8:46 and a half. If you take a look at the timelines for the Pentagon, it's even worse. Those planes made a U-turn and headed directly back for Washington, D.C., without radio contact, without transponder, off their assigned course. And nothing was done. Again, a stewardess reported the hijacking. And still, nothing was done. 2 minutes after the stewardess reported, yes, indeed, this isn't just a problem, this is a hijacking, NORAD could have been notified. That would have allowed the F-16s from Langley Air Force Base to be scrambled, airborne by 9:04, and they could have been over the Pentagon at 9:18. That's 19 minutes before American Flight 77, if that's what it was. Something flew into the Pentagon at 9:37. I won't go into more detail. The conclusion to me, as a former fighter pilot, is this. If normal communications, common sense actions had taken place between the airlines, air traffic control, FAA, NORAD, and the interceptor bases, the interceptors would have arrived in time to save both the World Trade Center and the Pentagon with many minutes to spare. So while I conclude that the fighter pilots themselves were not culpable, somebody was. And the question is, who was it? One clue is that in June of 2001, just 3 months before 9/11, a new directive came out at the Pentagon, and it stated that all requests to NORAD for intercepting hijacked airliners had to be approved by the Secretary of Defense. Mr. Rumsfeld. All he had to do to stop things was do nothing. Regardless of where the fault lies, one would think that some of these questions would be asked in Washington, D.C. at the official inquiry and not have to be asked at a forum like this with us American ordinary folks. But those questions haven't been asked. One would think that someone would be blamed, that someone in the FAA dropped the ball and forgot to call NORAD. Or someone at NORAD got the information and sat on it. Or something. Somebody. No one has been court-martialed. No one has been reprimanded. No one has been demoted. No one is to blame. That only tells me one thing. The ones to blame are too high up to play scapegoat. And the gap, again, to me, is treason. Now, since the whole reason for 9/11 was the Middle East, the insistence of our government maintaining troops in Saudi Arabia a decade after the first Gulf War gave them an excuse to put them in there, keeping those troops there allowed Osama bin Laden not only to get pissed off, but to find 15 angry young men willing to give their lives to punish the great Satan. All that, of course, assuming the story of Arab hijackers is accurate. The whole reason for allowing it to happen, if that's what happened, was as an excuse for regime change in Iraq. The war against Iraq that was planned way back at the end of the first Gulf War by PNAC, by the Bushies and the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds and the Wolfowitzes and the Pearls. They resurrected their plan and updated it in 2000. Before Bush became president, President Clinton wasn't interested, but as soon as George W. Bush was in the White House, this became priority one. What we are doing here this week is speaking truth to power. And when it comes to the Iraq war, here is the truth that we proclaim. This war has nothing to do with national security or freedom or democracy or human rights or protecting our allies or weapons of mass destruction or defeating terrorism or disarming Iraq. It has to do with money. It has to do with oil. It has to do with 14 permanent military bases. And it has to do with raw imperial power. It's based on a pack of lies, and it's wrong. Those who forced this war on an unwilling world are guilty of violating the U.S. Constitution, the U.N. Charter, and international law. What they have done is illegal, immoral, unconstitutional, and treason. It's been said that somewhere in Texas, there's a village looking for its idiot. Now that may be funny, but it misses the point. George W. Bush is not an imbecile, he is a traitor. Before this war started, we knew that it would fracture NATO, split the United Nations, separate us from our allies, and destroy the great nation south of here that we inherited from our fathers who died in World War II. And it has. We knew it would make our beloved country feared and hated, an outcast from the world community, a pariah among the peoples, and the number one rogue nation on earth. And it has. It has done so based on a pack of lies. My sisters and brothers, this is not stupidity. It is treason. We knew that this sadistic corporate war would incense the Arab world, provide thousands of new Osama bin Ladens, and enormously increase the terrorist threat. And it has. We knew it would further endanger the American people and destroy our national security. And it has. That is not stupidity. It is treason. As a combat veteran, I will not stand idly by and watch our security destroyed by a president who went AWOL rather than fight in Vietnam. Honor requires that I call this by its right name. It is treason. As one who has devoted his life to the security of his country, I will not stand by and watch an appointed president send our sons and daughters around the world to kill Arabs for the oil companies without calling it by its right name. It is treason. I joined the Air Force many, many years ago to protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Halliburton, and Exxon. We've had enough corporate wars. No more Iraqs. No more El Salvadors. No more Kosovos. No more Colombias. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interest of the wealthy few. It is a new colonialism. It violates the Constitution of the United States. It endangers our people. And it is treason. As a pilot who flew 101 combat missions in Vietnam, I can tell you that the best thing our government can do for its combat veterans is to quit making more of us. Peace is patriotic. A preemptive war is immoral, illegal, unconstitutional, a war crime, and treason. I swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that includes a renegade president. It's time for George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and the whole oil mafia to be removed from office and indicted for treason. We are the people. We are sovereign. We are the patriots. The whole world is with us. Never allow anyone to intimidate you into silence. It's time to speak truth to power. It's time to change our government, regime change in Washington. Now, people sometimes say, you know, it's awful easy to criticize. Do you think you could do any better? And I say, you darn right I do. Since 1992, I have been writing an occasional State of the Union address. And I'm not going to give you the whole ball of wax tonight. You can read it on my website. The handouts that I have for you will refer you to it. I have in here a complete domestic policy. After all, us down south of the border there, you know, what do you call a country whose principal exports are wood pulp and scrap metal, whose principal imports are manufactured goods, and whose fastest growing industry is building and operating private prisons? You call it a third world country. Down there in the United States, we've got a bounteous and beautiful land, a skillful and creative workforce, an inspired constitution. We've had the opportunity to create a land without want. And the question is, what went wrong? Why are our workers paid such a tiny percentage of their true worth? Why are we the only major nation without a national health program? Why are our high school graduates 2 years behind their counterpart in other countries? Why are we hated by so many around the world? Why do we have hundreds of thousands of troops patrolling foreign lands and supporting foreign dictators? What is going on? The answer is that we have lost our republic. Legislators no longer represent the people who elect them, but the corporations who finance them. They answer not to their constituents, but to the lobbyists who line their pockets and fill their campaign coffers. For years, the world's billionaires have directed U.S. policy for their own personal profit. This has included things like NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, but it has also included a series of wars from Iraq to Bosnia to Kosovo to Afghanistan and to Iraq again. Wars which are never in the interest of those fighting them or of the families left behind. Wars which only serve the insatiable greed of the global investor class. Corporate power over our political system, over the media, and over most aspects of our lives is the greatest danger we face today. It goes far beyond George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. Curtailing this power and restoring it to we the people is our greatest challenge. Those of us who dedicate our lives to peace, economic justice, and environmental preservation can make little progress in our struggles so long as ultimate power is in the hands of those who profit from war, poverty, and pollution. I'm not going to go into my domestic program. It includes things like guaranteeing every American access to a good education, a decent job at a living wage, health care through a doctor-run single-payer national health program, and the undiluted protections of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Fear of terrorism should not make our country a police state. But I want to quote the last third of my State of the Union address, the part that outlines our new role in a changing world. So if you would just for a few minutes pretend that I'm the President of the United States making my State of the Union address. In half a century, the United States has gone from savior of the civilized world to the most feared and hated nation on earth. This, in turn, has made our citizens at home and abroad the prime target of thousands of desperate, fanatical terrorists. With our belligerence, our arrogance, our name-calling, our overwhelming military superiority, our unilateralism, and our troops stationed in 150 countries, we have isolated ourselves from the world community. The end result of all this is that despite spending more than $1 billion a day on military power, the American people are less secure than at any time since the end of the Civil War. Tens of billions of dollars for Star Wars weapons, thousands of nuclear weapons, hundreds of thousands of troops, and the expenditure of $12 trillion since World War II have brought our people only more insecurity, massive debt, and the loss of many of the cherished rights enshrined in our Constitution. It's time for the cycle to end. It's time to end the belligerence, bring home our troops, and rejoin the family of nations. And that's exactly what we're going to do. I've got a lot of specifics on the website. I want to skip to just the most important. One is Iraq. On behalf of the government of the United States, I would like to apologize to our men and women in the armed forces and their families. To the people of Iraq, to the United Nations, and to the world's people. Undoing the damage done by our illegal, unconstitutional, immoral war of aggression against Iraq will be impossible, but we'll do what we can. We will help the Iraqis rebuild their country, their infrastructure, and their society. We will try to rebuild our credibility and our reputation as a nation, but we can't do it as an occupying army. We can only do it as part of a transition force led and directed by the United Nations. I intend to go to the UN and ask them to take full charge of the situation, including providing security, the letting of rebuilding contracts, and the operation of the oil fields. Now, this isn't going to sit well with the oil mafia which gave us this war. They want to control Iraqi oil and indeed all the oil in the Middle East. Well, it's not going to play well with Halliburton and all of its subsidiaries profiting from no-bid contracts. Sorry, guys, but what you want no longer counts. What counts is the security needs of the American people, and the American people need us to stop being an arrogant, go-it-alone rogue nation. We, of course, will not be able to restore the hundreds of lives lost on both sides of this tragic war. We will not be able to restore the lost limbs to the many thousands of young Americans injured in the war, nor to the tens of thousands of Iraqis. We won't be able to erase the memories of Iraqis tortured and humiliated in Abu Ghraib. Some mistakes just can't be undone. All you can do is learn from them and make sure they don't get made again. One thing is for sure, there will be no more preemptive attacks on my watch. I'm directing the Secretary of Defense to start bringing all our troops home, starting with those in Saudi Arabia. And this brings us to terrorism, the excuse now for continuing this war. Terrorism is both a short-term and a long-term problem. In the short term, we must protect the American people from the terrorists our policies have already created. This means enhancing port security, beefing up cockpit doors, strengthening the border patrol, introducing computerized tracking of aliens, funding local communities for first response activities, shoring up the Coast Guard, improving communications between intelligence agencies. These we will do. That's the easy part. It also means developing new ways of detecting and neutralizing weapons of mass destruction, work that's going on at the Defense Threat Reduction Agency at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, not getting enough money and enough attention. But in the long term, we must stop making more terrorists. This means stopping policies and actions which make people fear and hate us. It means listening to the legitimate grievances of people that we have wronged and then changing our ways. Only one thing has ever ended a campaign of terror: separating the terrorists from the larger community which supports them. This is done by ending the feelings of desperation, hopelessness, and powerlessness afflicting the people. It is done by listening to them and then actually making their lives better. It is not done by revenge and retaliation, which only create more terrorists. If retaliation worked, the Israelis would be the world's most secure people. In the end, we can have revenge or we can have security. We cannot have both. The way I read the Constitution, the job of the president is not to make the American people feel good by exacting revenge. Making people feel good's a job for a queen. My job is to make the American people secure. And to do that, we must change our government's ways so that we're no longer feared and hated. And that's exactly what we will do. We have at times had a government with bad policies. We've recently been through quite a few of those. But we're a good people. What we have long needed is a government which reflects the values and goodness of the American people. We intend to give you that kind of government. Here's some examples, specifics again. Our values and goodness are not reflected by a government which uses the people's money to train death squads in the techniques of torture, intimidation, and assassination. The School of the Americas, by whatever name they choose to call it, has been responsible for unspeakable atrocities wherever its graduates have gone. It must and will be closed. As Commander-in-Chief, I'm ordering the students presently attending the school be shown the movies Romero and Panama Deception and then sent home. It's the right thing to do. Our values and goodness are not reflected by a government which gives most favored nation status to the butchers of Tiananmen Square and places an illegal secondary embargo on the impoverished people of Cuba. The embargo of Cuba must end, and it just did. We desperately need good advance information on the activities of Al-Qaeda and those who wish to do us harm. But our values and goodness are not reflected by, and our security is not enhanced by, an organization which promotes instability, insurrection, tyranny, torture, terrorism, murder, and war around the world in our name and with our money. If the CIA won't stick to gathering information, I will abolish it. It's the right thing to do. Our Constitution outlines broad missions for the Department of Defense. These missions are notable for what they do not include. They do not include protecting the worldwide financial interests of multinational corporations, and we won't. If the global robber barons insist on using force to subjugate third world peoples, at least they can use their own ill-gotten money and hire their own mercenaries. Why should American taxpayers provide their own sons and daughters and then get stuck with the bill? Our values and goodness are not reflected by a government which sends its youth around the world to kill the sons and daughters of working people in other countries. Our values and goodness are not reflected by sending our children to the Middle East to kill Arabs so the oil companies can profit from selling the oil under their sand, making us the target of terrorists. As president, I will use the men and women in our armed forces to protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita, Banana, Halliburton, and Exxon. With nearly 60 years having passed since World War II, and with the Cold War long since over, there is no reason why we should still be occupying Germany and Japan. We will continue to provide peacekeepers when requested by the United Nations. The rest of our global military presence will end. This is not isolationism. It is common sense. It is in the interest of our people, and it is obeying our Constitution for a change. Every president in recent memory has violated our founding documents with foreign military ventures. Treason. At my inauguration, I swore to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. Lip service isn't enough. We must treat the Constitution as if it mattered, and I intend to do just that. Instead of a worldwide military presence, we're going to have a humanitarian presence. Along with the other wealthy nations of the world, we shall initiate a new Marshall Plan, providing funds to rebuild the Middle East as we rebuilt Europe after World War II. We will also take the lead in complete debt forgiveness for the poorest countries, starting with those in Africa. If we are once again to be a great nation, we must first be a good nation. We must build an America at peace with the world and with its own people. An America that seeks not to be king of the hill, nor subservient to the World Trade Organization, but to be a responsible, sovereign member of the family of nations. An America that is free of the threat of terrorism because it is no longer feared and hated. An America that leads the world not with military might, but with its vision, its compassion, its democracy, its productivity, its freedom, its standard of living, its treatment of its own people, its commitment to truth, and its goodness. That's the kind of an American that our people deserve. And that's the kind of America we will become. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Robert Bowman speaking at Phase 2 of the Grassroots International Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11, held late last May in Toronto. Thanks to Hamooks, Snowshoe Films, and the organizers and videographers of the Citizens Inquiry for that recording. For more on the ongoing effort, including Phase 3, which will be held in New York City in September, visit www.911inquiry.org. To access our MP3 archive of past shows, visit www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.